This is Sermonsmith, a bi-weekly conversation about the craft of sermon preparation, and my name is John Chandler. Our guest today is Kendall Rothes. Kendall is the pastor of Covenant Baptist Church, which is on the fringe of San Antonio, Texas. This is the first time I actually ran across Kendall was when she was recommended to me, even though she's only an hour away, but it was a pleasure to talk to her and get to know her. I think you'll enjoy hearing how she brings her poet spirit into the sermon prep process. Before we move on to today's interview, our partner today is Audible. Audible audiobooks. I consider listening to Audible books to be sermon prep on the go. Probably every year I get to work through about 12 to 15 audiobooks just by listening for 20 to 30 minutes, you know, each day as I'm driving around in my car here and there to different meetings or to work at a coffee shop or something like that. And I really find a lot of value in it, especially if I listen to narrative kind of books, memoir, history, or real practical books. The book I'd recommend for you to give a listen to today, if you want to try Audible, is Talk Like Ted by Carmine Gallo. If you've been a speaker for a long time, it might not be a book that's going to be full of new ideas for you, but it's one of those where you just go back and you listen through and it gives you some good pointers, good refreshers, reminders, and maybe even a few ideas you want to try for your own sermon prep. So that's Talk Like Ted by Carmine Gallo. If you go to audibletrial.com/sermonsmith, you can get a free book, and that can be the book you choose or anything else from their library. And that's a way that you can support the show as well. Again, it's audibletrial.com/sermonsmith. Thanks to those of you who have shown your support. And before we get on with the interview, one last thing. Would love it if you would drop in to iTunes and leave a review with a few words even about the podcast and how it's been helpful for you, or maybe ideas or suggestions you have for the show. That's just one of the ways that Apple looks and sees who's listening to what podcasts and finds new ones to recommend. So I'd appreciate that, and let's move on to Kendall Rothes. I am here with Kendall Rothes, and Kendall is just down the road from me, relatively speaking, down in San Antonio. I'm up in Austin. So, Kendall, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks
for having me. Yeah, I'm glad to have you on. You are just north of San Antonio at a church called Covenant. It's a Baptist church there. It's a contemplative Baptist church there. So why don't you tell us about Covenant? Tell us about the context where you preach.
Sure. Yeah, Covenant is just to the north of San Antonio, kind of in a patch of woods outside the 1604 loop.
Yeah.
And we have about 5 acres at our church. So we have some prayer paths that wander through the trees and have an outdoor labyrinth. And our sanctuary has windows that look out on the trees. So we have a real appreciation for nature and the beauty of God's world. We're a small church, figuring out what it means to say that we're contemplative. I think for us, that means we like to attempt to slow down from the fast pace of life, listen to God with some intentionality, and we take a gentle and slow approach to faith and to worship.
Is that contemplative Baptist?
Mm-hmm.
How common would that kind of, I mean, is there a movement of contemplative Baptists that you would say you're affiliated with, or are you unique?
Well, I don't know that there's a movement. I actually came from a contemplative Baptist church in Waco when I was in seminary, Day Spring Baptist Church. But I wasn't even aware that there were other congregations like that when I was in Waco. So I would say we're fairly unique, but we're not the only one. And I think just generally speaking, you see a lot of churches across a wide variety of traditions that are tapping back into the contemplative tradition and various spiritual practices.
Yeah. So what, talk about then, because you are a contemplative Baptist, like how does that shape what your Sundays look like?
Yeah, I think one of the maybe noticeable things about our worship service is that we do make time for silence as a part of our worship. We don't have long silences, but every worship service there'll be moments where that's all we're doing is just sitting there listening or praying or whatever. We're also not really in a hurry So we don't have filler music in between everything. It's sort of a deliberately slower pace than the rest of life. And then hopefully also there's a emphasis on listening to God. And we may occasionally practice, you know, Lectio Divina in a service, or incorporate some other practices like that as well.
Yeah. I'm going to, let's pause here. It is distorting a little bit, so I'm just going to go ahead and go to, let's just turn off our cameras and see if we get better audio quality.
Okay.
Sometimes it helps. All right. Okay. I promise I'll totally pay attention.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Okay. And so within the role of that, and within the role of the life of your congregation, how does preaching fit? Like, what is the role of preaching in a contemplative service like that, or in your congregation overall?
Yeah. Just in terms of our worship structure, preaching is a part of the way we encounter God, and it fits in between, you know, prayers of the people and a prayer of confession and various music. But I would say Covenant tends to value preaching. I think the way I view it is it's sort of that, it's the moment in the service where we really open up a place in scripture and open our hearts to hearing from God in a fresh way. And I definitely view the sermon as invitational, in the sense of invitation to enter God's presence, invitation to imagine the stories of scripture, invitation to, you know, enter the word and let the holy words transform you and change you.
Yeah. And do you preach every week? You mentioned Lectio, so I assume sometimes you do that. But do you preach every week? Are there other preachers in the church?
I preach most weeks. I'm the only staff person at Covenant, but we do have, actually in our small congregation, we have several seminary trained people as members of our congregation. So they fill in as needed, or sometimes even when I'm there, I find it's really great to be a part of the worship service and not preach sometimes, and get to experience what it's like to be in the congregation. And then another thing I try to do real intentionally is invite other people into the Covenant pulpit, both men and women, but particularly women, because it's still a challenge for women in the Baptist Church to find places to practice their preaching and to have the opportunity to begin using their voice. So I often, several times a year, have, you know, a young woman or a seminary student into the Covenant pulpit as nice. Well.
Well, that's, you're just segueing perfectly for me. So you are in a Baptist church in Texas, and
yes.
You are a woman who preaches.
Yes.
And Baptists have their own history with women in leadership in Texas, especially, as you probably know. And I won't go into detail all that for all of our non-Texas listeners, but there was a convention split many years ago with that issue being at one of the key ones anyway. So how, you know, what was the pathway for you to discover that you have this call, you have this passion, you have this desire to preach, and to find a way to do that?
Yeah, it was definitely a journey, because I grew up in Oklahoma, where it's, I would say, even harder for women preachers there than it is in Texas. And so I had never encountered a female pastor or a female preacher growing up, but I always had this interest in reading my Bible and thinking about how I would explain it to somebody else. So in some ways, I think of that call being in my life from a very early age, but just not having any idea how to interpret it. And so it was really when I went to college and I decided to major in theology and ministry, without really having any sort of clear sense of what I could possibly do with that degree, that as I began to take classes and encounter professors, and I was at a Nazarene university, which was much more open to women in ministry, I really began to hear a sense of call on a deeper level. But it really took me a good 3.5 out of the 4 years of college to wrestle with that and grapple with that and come out on the end saying, yeah, this is something I'm gifted at. This is something I feel called to. And this is something I can do. So I would say professors and peers who, you know, treated me as equals, was a big part of that process, is seeing that they believed in me. That was really important.
Yeah. And then what, so was the church that you're at now, were they looking for a woman?
No, not necessarily. I'm the first, female pastor they've had. But when they started their search process, they decided they wanted to be open to male or female, and that they just wanted to seek out the best fit for the church. And actually, I find this kind of interesting. I think the rumor is that their final three candidates ended up all being women. Oh. So it wasn't at all what they had intended, or they weren't trying for that, but it's what happened. To my knowledge, by the time I came to preach in view of a call, there was only one person in the congregation who wasn't quite sure yet how she felt about a woman pastor. And after the church voted for me to come, she had me over for lunch, and she told me that. She told me that she wasn't sure, and that she almost didn't come to church that Sunday where the church was going to vote, because she didn't want to be the dissenting voice if she couldn't say yes. But she came anyway, and then in about 3 days, you know, we were best buds. And, you know, when she heard me preach, I think it just changed for her. So that was really, I don't know if there were any other people before that were struggling with it. But I think in Baptist life, at least, there's still a lot of people who simply haven't encountered a woman pastor or a woman preacher. And so it's a little easier to feel a sense of objection when you haven't actually met a real female preacher in real life.
Because I mean, I'm thinking back through the women who I've interviewed even on SermonSmith already, and I think most of them, I mean, one of them is on the West Coast, but I think most of them are from northern states. So I don't even know if that's even a little bit of an image of what it looks like. It's just not as common of a thing, perhaps, in this part of the country.
Right. Yeah, I think it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us, you know, as you look ahead and as you map out your preaching, you know, how do you plan out topics or texts? You know, how far in advance do you determine what you're going to preach on, and why do you choose the things you choose?
Well, most of the time I follow the lectionary.
Okay.
And I like doing that for a couple of reasons. One is that it sort of forces me to preach on some texts I might not have wanted to choose otherwise. But I like the sense that churches all around the world are looking at this same text at the same time. And you can get a lot of good discussion with other clergy and find a lot of online resources if you're preaching from the lectionary, because you're all sort of looking at the same text at the same time. I do occasionally go off the lectionary. I've done that a little more recently. For example, during Advent, I'd wanted to do this for a long time, where the 4 weeks of Advent, I looked at each of the four women who show up in Jesus's genealogy, which includes some pretty tough stories.
Yeah, they're not esteemed women.
So I did, 1 week on each woman. And then for Lent this year, we've been looking at not just what has Jesus done for us, but what has Jesus done for others? And if we're truly following Jesus, how does that affect our relationship with others? And so I've kind of diverted off the lectionary for that as well. But most of the time I follow the lectionary.
And when you do the lectionary, do you try to say for the next season, I'm going to do the gospel passages or the Old Testament passages, or do you try to cover all four, or how do you determine from within that selection?
Yeah, normally I kind of look ahead and say most of the time for a chunk of time, I'll stay in the gospels, and then for a chunk of time, I'll do the Old Testament text and then maybe an epistle. I just try to somewhat balance it out. I tend to be a little more drawn to either the gospel or the Old Testament. So I also try to make myself do an epistle every once in a while for some balance. But and every once in a while, I'll do a sermon where I blend the passages together. But most of the time, I focus on one story or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm preaching this week. I don't know if this will probably go live maybe even after Easter. I'm not sure, but we're in Lent right now, and I'm preaching this weekend, and it's Numbers. It's the story of Moses. It's the story of people who are grumbling and complaining, and they get bit by snakes, and then Moses creates a snake image and holds it up, and they look at it. Mm-hmm. So it's still pretty easy to look at the lectionary sometimes and say, "Ooh, I don't want to preach on that one."
Right.
but it blends in so well with John chapter 3. I'm saying, okay, no, I really am going to do this, and this is going to work well. But yeah, so I mean, all that to say, sometimes it is beneficial to mingle them together. But yeah, I find I often, as we do lectionary, want to just hone in on one of them as well. So, okay, well, that being the case, tell us about your timeline for putting a sermon together. I mean, do you start on Monday, or are you able to start weeks in advance and work on multiple at a time? How does that follow through?
I generally sort of just mostly tackle one sermon at a time. And so each week I'm completely immersing myself in that text or story. And I might look ahead a little bit in terms of just some general ideas or see where the text is going or the story is going, but I really mostly just write one sermon at a time. The way I start is to I take whatever text I'm preaching on, and I come to it without any other opinions, no commentaries, no articles. Just bring myself to the text, and I generally write down any questions I have, any objections I have, any thoughts I have, anything I'm curious about, what the characters are thinking, what they're feeling, what's missing that I really wish I could know, how this affects my own faith journey, where I am right now. And so I just kind of bring everything to the table that's going on in my own mind and heart, and let anything be stirred up. And that's where I start.
That would be like Monday morning, like start of the week.
Yeah. Well, I take Mondays off, but
okay. Tuesday morning.
Yeah. generally somewhere on Tuesday. And then I begin to, a lot of times I let all of that simmer for about a day or so. It depends on the text and how familiar I am with it or how much extra help I need. But at some point I would sort of turn to some outside resources and some commentaries and see what else I can gain or how the commentaries might provide helpful feedback to what I've been thinking. But I would say for the most part, my process has changed since seminary, and I'm a lot less research-based, and I use a lot more of the creative side of my brain. So I spend a lot less time in commentaries, and I spend a lot more time writing poetry, coloring if I need to, taking a walk, getting out a big blank white sheet of paper and not writing things in order at all, but just writing different ideas all over the paper. And so I've really leaned into a more creative approach versus a research-based approach, I guess you could say. So sometimes I never even open up a commentary, depending on the passage in the week.
Yeah. And so what brought, like, how did you discover that that worked better for you? Because I'm sure that's probably not what they taught in seminary.
No, they didn't. It's definitely developed over time. And part of it happened with, I used to go to the library every single week. I had like an appointment with myself at the library, and I would always start by pulling out all these, my favorite commentaries, and I would start there. But what I found is that some weeks I would do that and I was forcing myself to read this commentary article that wasn't inspiring me. And so I started giving myself more and more permission that if it wasn't speaking to me, to set it aside and write a poem instead, or set it aside and journal about the text instead, or set it aside and get very curious about the things that no commentator had ever mentioned before. And I began to figure out that works pretty well for me. I definitely think it's important to have a good background in scholarship. I would not be an advocate of just tossing aside scholarship.
Sure.
But in terms of where the inspiration and the heart and sort of the oomph of a sermon comes from for me, it tends to be those more creative, freewheeling moments than when I'm sitting at the library.
So in weeks where you maybe do both, mm-hmm. you know, in weeks where maybe you do engage with some commentary stuff, because maybe it's a passage you're not as familiar with, but you also do this, is there an order to which one of those comes first, or does that change?
I almost always start with my own ideas and questions and thoughts, because I don't want to get boxed in by what I read in a commentary. Mm-hmm. So I want to start with my own imaginative process. And then whatever I read in the commentaries or whatever I pick up on in my research, sometimes that has veto power. I realize, oh, my imagination probably took me to a non-helpful place. or it provides fresh insight. Or sometimes I start reading and thinking, oh, you know, this fits together with what I was already dreaming about. And so I let that scholarship piece inform my creative process and help shape it and mold it and maybe add another layer of richness to it.
Okay. And is that, so as you start to mold these two pieces together, you know, these mind meanderings, so to speak, mm-hmm. and then some of the study too, how does all that start to form? Like, at what point in the week do you start to say, okay, I have enough here, I have to start crafting this into something? And how do you do the work of forming that into, you know, presentable content?
Yeah. Generally, I always start to at least get something cohesive together on Thursday afternoon, at least the start of a cohesive piece.
Yeah.
That way I have time to kind of keep tweaking it. As far as how I do it, I don't know. It's just the way my brain works, I guess, because I do not start figuring out how I'm going to put the pieces together. I really do. It's like I've collected this huge pile and I think, how on earth does any of this fit together? And then I just make myself start writing and a cohesive thing comes out. I guess that's the way I'm wired, is to do all of that collecting. And then it's almost on a subconscious level that my brain begins, you know, piecing these things together. And often as I'm writing, I'm totally shocked. Something that I read 2 days ago just suddenly pops back in to the process and I had forgotten about it. So That's probably not helpful for
No.
advice, but that's kind of how it works for me.
No, I mean, this is the question I always like to dive into, because it's amazing how many of us don't really fully understand how we do that part.
Yeah.
But we do it because it happens somewhere along the way. And some have a very, aware understanding of how they pull that part together. So that's why I like to ask the questions to draw it out. And I find people are often discovering it even as I'm asking the questions. Oh yeah, that's what happens. So imagine, just for the semantic, or not the semantics of it, but the pragmatics of it, you've got, all of these scrawlings and all that, and these notes. I take it though that you just kind of have those off to the side, but when you say you start writing, you're just opening up a blank Word document or a blank sheet of paper and just starting to write with what's in mind? Or are you starting with one of those documents where you've already scratched out a bunch of notes and starting to build on that?
I would say I'm mostly starting with a blank document. Occasionally in the all the sort of just scribbling I've been doing, I will write something that I think, oh, that is for sure going in the sermon, and I'll kind of put a star by it, and I'll know to come back to that later, like I want this sentence exactly how I wrote it the first time, sort of thing. But most of the time I've done all of that, and then I start with a blank document. And what has happened over the last year or so is I've started almost exclusively handwriting my sermons, because I've found that that really does tap for me a deeper level of my creativity, and I just seem to come out with something that's richer, and it flows for me much smoother that way. Of course, then I have to go back and type it all out on the computer and print it out, but in terms of the quality, for me, handwriting just it does something. I think it taps a different side of my brain to write it out by hand.
So sometimes I get really nerdy and insatiably curious. Do you have a favorite notebook or a kind of paper and a favorite pen?
Well, interestingly, I've found that I we have these, oversized pieces of, paper for when you're printing off an oversized document, just plain white paper. And I tend to be drawn to pulling that out the most and just scribbling on something. For some reason, the fact that it's just this piece of paper that you could throw away, like, I think it gives me more a sense of freedom. Like, if I have this, when I'm using my beautiful little journal with the nice little straight lines, like something in me thinks what comes out has to be perfect, whereas when I give myself this big sheet of paper, something about it is saying to me, open up your imagination. I often will just draw crooked on the paper, or I don't know. I have to have, I guess I'm trying to create a space visually that invites me to be imaginative. And sometimes the straight little lines in my journal almost lock me in. So I do have many journals, but then I find myself just pulling out a sheet of paper instead. So, yeah.
And so that happens on Thursday, or starts on Thursday. Like, how long does that process? I mean, can you kind of bang it out by Thursday evening, or is that like, when do you actually get to a point where you can say, okay, this is ready to go and I can type it into my computer now?
That tends to depend a lot on my mood on Thursday. If I'm in a sort of peaceful, uninterrupted spot,
A contemplative
yes,
spot.
contemplative spot, I can get the bulk of it, in one setting. Definitely, I generally don't, every once in a while I get the whole thing, but generally it's just the bulk of it. But of course, things happen, or stressful things, or you get interrupted, or, so sometimes I find myself doing a good piece of the sermon on Friday instead, or finishing it up on Saturday. I love to finish by Friday so I can relax and review it on Saturday, but that doesn't happen as much as I'd like.
Yeah. So how do you know when it's done? Besides Sunday at whatever time.
Right. Yeah, sometimes you just run out of time and not being productive. And other than that, I would say it's just it's a feeling I have. I have a feeling of completeness. Like, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. I can probably tweak a sermon, you know, over and over and over again. but I kind of know when I've hit this is at 96%, you know, this is done. And anything I do from here on out is the remaining 4% that I could tweak for months if you let me, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's just, yeah, for me, it's a feeling.
Do you have I mean, so far we've really described your process for a particular, you know, given sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Like anybody who does a fair amount of preaching, you know, and I mean, I know you've also written a book we'll talk about here in a little bit. So there's some writing going on there. I would imagine then for you that there's always ideas that are coming around, you know, when you're in the grocery store or, you know, wherever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any kind of process where you try to capture those and tuck those away for later to think about them more or to work them into a sermon or how do you do that kind of thing?
I carry a journal with me at almost all times. And so if I have a thought that feels significant, I've pretty much developed a practice of I stop and write it down whenever it's possible. And you know, I mean, I'm a thinker, so I'm always thinking, but sometimes it's just the thought strikes me in a certain way that I just know I've got to capture this, you know, and other thoughts, you know, you just let them come in and go out. But when I have that feeling of this is something I want to capture, or I want to remember that thought exactly with the word, this, the exact words I just thought of it, then, 8 times out of 10 or 9 times out of 10, I will find time to get out my journal and jot it down.
Yeah. And then at some point you just go back and review what you've written, or just the process of writing it down helps internalize it?
I would say for the most part, just the process of writing it down helps me internalize it, and it will pop back up at a later time without me having gone back and reread it.
Yeah. So I listened to one of your sermons,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was maybe from 1 or 2 weeks ago. It's about loving your enemies.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, one of the things that I noticed because I don't do this well at all. I like to talk about big, grand ideas and not bring them down to everyday life. And one of the things that I noticed that you did just really well in there and just on an ongoing basis is you kept drawing. And with one like love your enemies, I suppose it's a little easier, but you kept drawing it into this is what this might look like Wednesday afternoon, or, you know, you just continually gave relatable examples from people's day-to-day life. Is that an easy thing for you to do as you're writing, or do you have to work hard to like put yourself in the shoes of people who are part of Covenant to think through how they might need to ingest what you're talking about?
I think that is, it's really natural for me to think about preaching and interpreting scripture in terms of, you know, what does this mean in the concrete way I spend my days and my hours. And actually I don't really tend to think, in terms of, what are the people around me? How are they going to hear this? And how are they going to apply it? It sounds almost selfish, but I'm really thinking, how does this strike me? And where do I struggle? And how do I overcome that struggle? And how does this passage affect my own faith journey? And what I've found is that when you sort of trust what's most deeply personal and true for you, it tends to have a sort of universal quality to it. And so I've really, it took me a while, but I've really leaned into that sense of you know, whatever struggle I have with struggling, whatever struggle I have with loving my enemies, for example, probably most of the people in the room have that very same or very similar sort of internal thing going on.
Yeah.
And so that's I would say that's kind of the way I think about it most weeks.
It's an inside out vulnerability. Almost sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Talk about your book, because you just published a book earlier this year about preaching. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. My book is Preacher Breath. I've wanted to write a book for a long time, so it's exciting to have it be out in the world. It's a book on preaching in a way, but it's also a book on just sort of anybody, I think, that's trying to use their voice in the world in an authentic and meaningful way. And how do we do that as wholehearted people? And so the book is divided into essays. And then in between each essay, there are a couple of my sermons between each essay. So the essays are things like heart, soul, voice, skin, brain, bones, veins, legs. And each of those things stand for something. So, you know, the essay on skin is about vulnerability in preaching. An essay on brain is about imagination and preaching. And so I think the book is about a sort of fully embodied experience of preaching and pastoring, but also living, you know, living as our full selves in the world and as we use our voices.
From listening to your sermon, it sounds like you pretty much almost completely manuscripted out.
Yes.
Do you find that translates well to the written? I mean, do you feel like it carries pretty much almost the same as reading it in your book as it does?
Well, I certainly, you know, when I write a sermon, I'm writing it to be heard.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a certain, you know, obviously there's an inflection of my voice and the tone with which I would read it. That, of course, if you're just reading the sermon, you miss that part. But all of my sermons are manuscripted. I sort of figured out about myself early on that writing was my strength. I really love the cadence of words and the ability to arrange them in a poetic way. And I decided, okay, I'm going to manuscript these sermons because that's my strength. And then I will in time figure out how to deliver them so that they don't sound like they're being read to you, but that there's a conversation happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously you write as well because you wrote the book. Do you find that when you're writing for an audience to read versus writing for a sermon, like, do you almost enter into different writing modes for each of those, even though they're both a manuscript?
I would say they're fairly similar. It's a little different when I know I'm going to get to read out loud what I've written and kind of put emphasis where I want. But I would say for the most part, it's pretty similar. I also write a lot of poetry as well. And I find that the more I write, the more all of those things blend together rather than being distinct from one another.
Yeah. I mean, I could hear that even as I listened to your sermon, that there's a sense of verse over prose, even in some of the things that you, as you were saying it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, all that being said, as you think through other, I always like to ask people, like, what are books that you've read or other resources that you think would be helpful for anyone who's just continuing? Like, what's helped shape you as a preacher and how you approach the craft that you think might be beneficial for others?
Well, I always say that probably my favorite preacher is Barbara Brown Taylor. And so just reading her sermons, not that I've tried to imitate or copy her, but I've tried to notice, okay, what is so good about what she's doing? She has this crisp, concise language that really appeals to me. And I think, you know, reading or listening to preachers that you think are really good is really helpful. But also something I do is not just, you know, paying attention to preachers, but anybody who's a good speaker, and listening to what is it that makes them communicate well, and learning from that. I also really like slam poetry, and I compete sometimes, but also listening to the other slam poets. So I think opening myself up to a variety of ways of communicating, not just preaching, but listening to poets and to authors and various speakers, and letting all of them influence me has been important.
Yeah, for sure. Is there a lively slam poetry culture in San Antonio?
There is. I tend actually to go to the Austin Poetry Slam, so close to you. The one in Austin is very well attended, and they have some great poets there, and I highly recommend it.
Interesting. I might have to email you later and say, tell me when and where that is. So we'll have a Sermonsmith meetup there.
Okay.
All right. So, I mean, you talk about that. Are there other books you feel like that have been good for shaping you or how you speak?
Well, certainly shaping how I pastor, I would say Eugene Peterson's Contemplative Pastor.
Yeah.
Has really been meaningful to me. And in an indirect way, I think that does shape how I speak, because to me, that book is so much about who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. And I believe who you are shapes how you speak and how you communicate. So that's been a really important book to me. Reading the poetry of Mary Oliver. Really, there's a lot of poets. I've enjoyed Frederick Buechner's writing. That's another person who, I guess more his writing than, I haven't really heard him speak, but the way he writes.
More his fiction stuff or his memoir stuff?
Listen to Your Wife, I believe.
Yeah.
Is the name of, I was confusing that with a Parker.
I knew that. I thought that's where you let your life speak.
Anyways, it's just a selection of various things that he's written. And that's what I've been reading most recently. And he just has this way of using words that is really captivating.
All right. Well, Kendall, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is there anything that you could add to all of this conversation that you feel like is helpful, but maybe I haven't even explicitly asked about?
I would just perhaps say to anyone who's starting out preaching is that I think one of the most important things for me has been finding my own voice. And cultivating that and figuring out what that is. And there can be a lot of pressure, I think, to sound like other great preachers, or to copy what you've seen. But I think leaning into what your strengths are and leaning into your ideas, even if they're a little out of the box, that's the best way to start cultivating your voice and your unique, way of contributing to the task of preaching. And so I feel like it's, you know, it takes time that you can't really have your own voice, your first sermon.
Sure.
But if you keep working with it, I really think it's possible for each of us to sort of cultivate that. And for me, leaning into my strengths is how I've gotten there.
How long did that take you?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know when to say this is when I found my voice. in a way it helped that I had never heard a female preacher because I didn't have anybody to copy. It was sort of like, well, no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to sound like this big booming male pastor that I've grown up with, you know? So I kind of had to start from scratch in a way. But it certainly has helped me recently. What I mentioned about the slam poetry is performing my poetry, not just slam poetry, but in other venues. So using my voice in a different way, and in a different setting, that actually really strengthened my confidence and helped me find my true voice, I think. And then over time I started to sort of blend the poetry voice and the sermon voice.
I certainly know others who have done that through doing comedy. I think you're like they found their preaching voice by trying comedy. I think you get credit for being the first person I've talked to who's done it through poetry. Or at least that venue of poetry.
Comedy, so.
Well, if somebody wants to keep up with what you're up to, you know, what's the church's website or your website or Twitter? And is there any videos of you online doing poetry that I could even put up there?
Oh, well, the church site is covenantbaptist.org. And then I have a blog, Kindle Ray, KYNDALLRAE.com. And I believe there's an old video of me doing poetry on there.
All right.
I don't know if I have any poetry videos. I might have a few. I'll send them to you.
Okay. And then Twitter, do you tweet?
I do not.
You do not tweet.
Yeah.
That's
I can only handle so much social media, and I have Facebook.
No. That's probably good because there's nothing contemplative about Twitter.
No, I wouldn't say it was.
All right.
Although they do make you be concise on Twitter. So.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Well, Kendall, thanks so much. Very much a mutual friend connected us, and I'm thankful to him because I knew you'd have a unique voice to bring to the conversation just from the little bits I saw and read about you early on, and I think that's the case. I'm thankful you were able to make time.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Yeah, and hopefully sometime soon when you're in Austin, we can connect and meet in person.
Okay, I'll let you know about the poetry slam.
Yeah, I'd like to know.
Okay.
All right, blessings.
All right, thanks.